baseball fans, and welcome to our weekly edition here of A Podcast to Be Named Later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and there's a lot to get to today. We're going to be talking with Brandon C. Williams from RotoExperts.com. We're going to cover everything we can from week number 7 in the American League to the season on the whole. We're going to try to touch on everything. My rant this week, rather than being any specific topic or complaint, I guess, maybe I'm a whiner, I don't know. But this week I'm not going to whine, or at least not during the rant. So during Short Dog's rant, I'm just going to go over some stats through what we've seen in the last week, what we've also seen in the last month, and just year to date, look at some of the numbers that are noteworthy, things you may not have realized, or just information in general that's good to know when it comes to baseball. We're at the quarter pole, give or take a little bit here, and so it seems time now is as good as any, I would say, to look at things. The Red Sox lead are in second place in the American League East. Technically, they're tied with the Orioles. I'm looking at the standings as we speak. So we'll go over the standings in the American League. We'll also look, as I said, at the stats and who's hitting and who's not, who's pitching and who isn't, things like that. The Jays are in last place in the American League East. That's a surprise to me. I don't know if those out there realize that the Toronto Blue Jays are, while pitching pretty well, in last place in the American League East. So those are some things we'll talk about and we'll get into a little bit. The Red Sox have 6 of the top 18 players when it comes to WAR. If you go over to ESPN, they have that WAR stat, and there are limitations to WAR, so don't take it as the law of the land or anything like that. But nonetheless, WAR gives you an idea of how players are playing as an all-around talent. Hitting, running, hitting for power, hitting for contact, stealing bases, base running in general. It tries to factor in all of those things. And defense, which is kind of surprising as well, because that's where my biggest complaint about WAR and all of some of these advanced metrics are, is their factoring in of defense. It's very scattered. I think it's inconsistent. I think inefficient isn't the right word. Inaccurate maybe is a little bit. And you also have to remember that all the sites have their own equations to factor WAR. So you go to WAR for ESPN, you're going to find a different one than if it's FanGraphs or Baseball Prospectus or Baseball Reference. They all use their own. So depending on who you trust and who you want to believe, you're going to come up with a different WAR, which also means that all the talking heads across the country are using different WAR numbers. Now, I don't think they're drastically different, but nonetheless, they're not the same. They do use their own. So, and they don't tell us what those are, by the way. So we don't know if defense is 40% of the equation, or if it's 50%, or if it's 22%. We don't know. We don't know how much it hurts David Ortiz that he's a DH and therefore doesn't get that defensive value. But then you've got some players who are defensive liabilities, so it actually hurts them. So a DH would actually help them. We don't know those things. We don't know how they factor in base running exactly, and we don't know how much they factor it in. If a guy goes from first to third a lot, is it as simple as that? Do they look at a player and say, wow, this guy runs from first to third more than any other guy in baseball? Well, I guess that'd be interesting to know, but they don't tell us that, and no one talks about things like that. No one says Jackie Bradley goes from first to third better than any player in the game. Nobody says that David Ortiz is the worst at legging out a double off the bat. We don't know those exact kind of examples, but yet I have to assume that they factor those kinds of things into their metric, and we don't know how they do that. So that's a little bit, I guess that's my rant right there, my complaint with WAR. But nonetheless, it does more than batting average or just home runs or stolen bases. Stolen bases can be an empty stat. We're in a fantasy sports world, but nonetheless, stolen bases, some people argue, are meaningless, that they don't do any good. Now, granted, turning a single into a double because you stole a base, that's got to have some meaning, so I'm a little bit reluctant to say that stolen bases are worthless. But how many stolen bases lead to actual runs scored or have a significant positive impact on the game? That we don't really know, because no one talks about that either. We don't, as much as we have so many people out there trying to play detective and to minor league sleuth to try to give us all these interesting little stats, nobody tells you that Jacoby Ellsbury has turned more singles into doubles with stolen bases that have led to runs scored than anybody in baseball this season. That's a stat I would like to know. I would like to know that Billy Hamilton stole the least amount of meaningful bases in all of baseball in 2015, that 47% of his stolen bases did not lead to run scored. Those are things I would love to know, but they don't tell us those things. and we don't know if they factor into war. But nonetheless, those would be some interesting stats. So we'll get into the statistics, some of the things that have been going on recently, because we've got some interesting things. Jose Bautista seems like he's getting it together. Leonis Martin is quietly having a really nice season for the Mariners, and they got him for essentially nothing. They got him for a middle reliever. I believe his name is Wilhelmsen. He's been having a nice season out there in Seattle. For those of you out there who have play fantasy sports, if you've got Leonis Martin off the free agent wire or got him in the 20th round of your draft, you're getting some home runs, you're getting some stolen bases, and you know the batting average isn't really there. But nonetheless, he's having a nice season, and the Mariners are as well. They're leading the AL West. And while I'm not going to say that the Mariners are the best team in baseball, I'm not going to say they maybe even are the best team in the AL West, but or that Leonis Martin is why they're close to any of those things. But nonetheless, for those of you out there who don't pay a lot of attention to the West Coast or to the AL West or the Mariners in general, and a lot of people don't, they're kind of one of those hidden teams out there that people don't really listen to all that much. Leonis Martin's having a pretty nice season as a minor player, making more than a minor impact. So, well, he's having a nice season out there. If you haven't heard, and if unless you're living under a rock, I don't know how you haven't, Jackie Bradley on fire. Totally on fire. 27-game hitting streak. His OPS is right up there with some of the best in the game right now. The guy is just ripping it. And who would have thought that? He was hitting under 200 for a significant portion of 2015. He wasn't able to even make the Major League roster in 2014 in any meaningful way because he couldn't get on. He couldn't hit the ball. Literally, he couldn't hit over 200. And now he's probably the best player in baseball right now. I'm not saying he's the best player going forward or that if you could have any one player to start your entire organization, that Jackie Bradley's your man. I'm not saying that. I don't want you to even think that I'm even suggesting it. But Jackie Bradley is having a phenomenal season so far, and he's the MVP right now. The Red Sox are if not the best teams in the American League. Their offense is the best in the American League, and it's not even close. And Jackie Bradley is probably the best offensive player on that team. What David Ortiz has done has been phenomenal, and he's hitting the home runs even more than Bradley. So if you want to make an argument for David Ortiz as their best offensive player so far, I'm not gonna eat your lunch for you. But by OPS, if you just want to use one stat, OPS, I believe Jackie Bradley is the man. So he's having a phenomenal season. So we'll get into some more stats here in just a moment. We're also obviously going to be talking about the AL East, the AL West, and the AL Central. We'll break it down a little bit. We'll look at some of the interesting stats. We'll look at the numbers. We'll analyze the divisions a little bit. And hopefully we'll have time to talk a little bit of trade. It's a little early to be making trades, but I think it's not too early to say these guys are sellers. These teams are going to be buyers. And then there's some teams in the middle ground we say we don't know yet. The Toronto Blue Jays, like I said, are 22-24, last in the AL East. I don't think they're going to be sellers, but a team in their position normally would be looked at and considered as a possible seller. So that's one team. Minnesota is 11-32. Yeah, I think we can say that they're sellers at this point. The Red Sox are in the middle of the pack when it comes to pitching, and yet they're at the top of the AL East. They're probably going to be buyers, and I would say pretty obvious that they're probably going to be looking for pitching. So those are some of the characterizations and things we can evaluate, and we'll try to talk about today here on the program with Brandon C. Williams from rotoexperts.com. We'll do our players in focus. We'll touch on a little bit of some of the hot players in that segment as well. Chris Davis, Ian Kinsler, Melvin Upton. He's a National League player, but he's actually hitting a little bit recently. If we have time, I'd like to ask Brandon C. Williams about him. David Price has an ERA of 5.53. He's got, I believe, 6 wins on the season, so that's nice. No one really pays attention to the win category anymore. But nonetheless, you look at those numbers. He's got 6 wins. He's got a 1.27 whip, striking out a lot of players, but nonetheless, he's got a 5.53 ERA. I don't think the Red Sox defense is horrible. The whip isn't horrible, but a 5.53 ERA with a 1.27 whip with all those strikeouts, I don't know how David Price is doing what he's doing. It's a weird combination of stats, but we'll get into him a little bit. Chris Tillman, 2.61 ERA and a 1.16 whip. I've been a Chris Tillman follower for quite some time, frustrated at times, excited at others. He's always had potential and often not quite met it. But so far this season, at least, he's the Orioles ace on a staff that doesn't really have very much pitching, but they're nonetheless tied for the American League East title, and pitching has to have something to do with it. And so he's got a 2.61 ERA and a 1.16 whip. That's pretty nice. Cameron Maben returned to the field this week. He had a pretty nice week so far. He's got 4 home runs. He's been tearing the cover off the ball. For all of you daily fantasy sports fans out there, you got to be looking at Cameron Maybin. His price is pretty reasonable, and he's about as hot as you get when it comes to it. So you want to look at those matchups, of course. But Cameron Maybin having a nice first week as he returns to the Detroit Tigers lineup. I don't know if it's doing them a lot of good. They were 6-4 in their last 10, but they're down to 21-22 and in fourth place in their in the AL Central. So we'll get into that as well. And Yu Darvish is supposed to return on Saturday. I think we touched on him a little bit last week. We'll touch on him again this week and what we can expect. Is he, in fact, returning on Saturday? I'll ask Brandon C. Williams that question. And we'll see what the impact of Yu Darvish will be. The Rangers are only a game and a half back in the AL West. They get their best pitcher back. I don't know how Colby Lewis keeps pitching the way he has. He's been phenomenal. We'll touch on him a little bit in the stats section. But Yu Darvish has to help that staff. But how much does it? Is it going to be enough of an impact? And so we'll get into that a little bit here. So you're listening to a podcast to be named later. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. With me today is Brandon C. Williams. If you'd like to follow the program, you can do that on Facebook. It's a podcast to be named later. You can always follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73. I send out links to all of the programs and any news and notes that may be irrelevant, whether it be written or podcasting. So head on over to Twitter, at CJMitch73. You can read my content over at minorleagueball.com or rotoexperts.com, which is where you can find Brandon C. Williams as well. Let's get into a little bit of the stats. Now, I'll ask Brandon what these stats mean to him. I'll just got a few that I've been looking at here. Jose Bautista had 4 home runs this past week. So did Chris Davis. Miggy Cabrera was 11 for 22. So the Tigers had a tough stretch. They're fourth in their division, but Cabrera is 11 for his last 22. Evan Gattis comes back to play catcher for the Houston Astros. He was hitting 201 before he went down to Double-A. He comes back, plays a couple games, and all of a sudden the bat is kind of tearing it up. He has 3 home runs now that he's back at catcher in the last week. As I said, Leonis Martin, 11 for his last 20 at-bats, 3 home runs, a 1.69 OPS over the last week. As far as the year goes, as I said, Jackie Bradley, 27-game hitting streak. Colby Lewis, 2.75 ERA, 1.10 WHIP, which is good for 10th in the American League. Chris Sale, this is probably doesn't stun anybody, but the number is so impressive I figured I had to throw it out there. 1.58 ERA, phenomenal. Jose Quintana, second in the American League East in ERA, he's got a 1.98. I mean, look at that. You've got two pitchers with an ERA under 2 in the American League. That's pretty strong, I would have to say. You've got two lefties throwing darts for the Chicago White Sox. They should be probably further up in the leaderboard than that. But nonetheless, 1.58 for Chris Sale, 1.98 for Jose Quintana. To wrap out the final top five of the ERA leaders here, Felix Hernandez throwing under 90 miles per hour here, 2.21 ERA. Danny Salazar had a little bit of a rough outing against the Red Sox on Sunday, but as I've been kind of suggesting, everybody has rough outings against the Red Sox. He's got an ERA of 2.32. This kid's a monster. I was big into Carlos Carrasco coming into the season for the Indians, but I was almost as high on Danny Salazar, and he's really coming through. He's got 54.1 innings pitched, 67 strikeouts. That's just silly good. I believe that's leading the American League, or at least it's leading amongst the ERA leaders. That's the leader in the clubhouse right now, with 67 strikeouts in 54 innings. That's ridiculous. Chris Sale has 62 strikeouts in 68 innings. And yet Danny Salazar has 54.1 innings pitched and 67 strikeouts. That is just – that's just filthy. That is just plain filthy. And he had a struggle against the Red Sox. He got hurt early in the game. He got hit by a hard line drive by Hanley Ramirez. Technically, I guess you'd call it a ground ball, but it was like a one-hopper, and it hit him in the shin. Impacted him for a few batters, and I would think it impacted him a little bit for the entire game. He got himself together, had a solid outing. The line didn't look so great because he did have a rough first inning. But nonetheless, the kid is just throwing filthy darts out there. Rich Hill, seventh in the American League at 2.54. This guy signed for $6 million. A lot of people said it was an insane signing because he had, I believe, 6 or 7 starts for the Red Sox at the end of 2015. All of them were phenomenal. But again, he hadn't been in the major leagues in like 2 or 3 seasons. He was pitching an independent ball. Comes up, pitches well for the Red Sox, and all of a sudden Billy Beane out there in Oakland gives him a 1-year contract at $6 million. I thought it was the best signing of the offseason, at least the smartest, the most clever. And at least for now, he's proven it. 49.2 innings pitched, 59 strikeouts. So he's right up there with Chris Sale, and he's actually got more than Jose Quintana. He's got a lot more than Felix Hernandez, and nobody's got what Danny Salazar is throwing up there. But he's got a 2.54 ERA. Nice season for Rich Hill. Chris Tillman, as I mentioned before, tied for eighth in ERA, 2.61. And this one might be the stunner of them all. Colby Lewis. Yes, that Colby Lewis of the, I have never been a very good pitcher, but I've managed to stay in the major leagues for quite a long time, Lewis's. 2.75 ERA for the Texas Rangers. Their offense hasn't been horrible, but it hasn't been stellar either. It's not the Red Sox here. And yet they're right up there in the AL West, hanging close with the Seattle Mariners. And Colby Lewis has got to be a significant reason for it. 59 innings pitched, 2.75. That's a pretty impressive ERA there. If you want to get into the advanced stats, let me give you those real quickly. The WAR leaders, as I mentioned before, Adam Eaton. This is kind of what tells you what it is. Adam Eaton leads in WAR. If you believe that WAR is the stat that tells you who's playing well, then technically Adam Eaton is the best player in the American League. How many of you know who Adam Eaton plays for? For those of you who do, what position does he play? Where does he bat in the order? And how many years has he been in the major leagues? And was he always with the team that he's currently with? Or was he traded? Or what happened? Adam Eaton with a WAR of 3, you, ladies and gentlemen, leading the American League. Second, Jose Altuve. I don't think that would surprise you. When you combine base running, speed, defense, power, everything that he brings to the table, I don't think it would shock you if you put to say that Jose Altuve is having one of the best seasons in the American League. So for him to have a 2.9 WAR, just under the superstar Adam Eaton, I don't think that would stun you. Ian Kinsler, 2.4, is third. The Red Sox, as I said, have three of the top 10 players in WAR. Mookie Betts, Xander Bogaerts, Travis Shaw, Jackie Bradley, and Big Poppy. Those are all in the top 15. And then Dustin Pedroia is in the top, is 16. So that rounds out the six players at the top of the list with WAR. And that's one thing another thing that confused me about WAR. Jackie Bradley is 12th in WAR, and yet he's got a monster OPS. He's having a phenomenal overall season. He's hitting 27 straight games. He is considered one of, if not the best defenders in all of baseball, and yet he's 12th in WAR. That I don't quite – that's one of the problems right there. Jackie Bradley playing center field, and I think you get bonuses for that kind of thing. If you play first base versus playing shortstop versus playing center field versus playing right field, playing catcher, for example, you get a lot of – you get a boost in WAR based purely on the position you play. Because and that makes sense. I'm not criticizing him for that. It makes sense. But nonetheless, Jackie Bradley is considered one of the best players in the game, plays one of the most demanding positions in center field. He's got an OPS that is completely and totally off the charts. The guy is killing it, and yet he's 12th. I don't quite understand that. He's got an OPS of 1.031. He's got 33 RBIs. He's got 52 base hits and 152 at-bats. That leads to a .342 batting average, .413 on-base percentage. He's got 8 home runs. He's actually stole two stolen bases. He scored 23 times. He does bat at the bottom of the order, and maybe that's killing him. I don't know. How do you have one of, if not the best offensive players in the American League right now, who's one of, if not the best defensive players in the league? He plays one of the toughest positions on the diamond, and yet he's 12th in WAR. Behind Travis Shaw, who plays third base, a mediocre third base. He's behind Ian Kinsler. He's behind Adam Eaton. He's just barely ahead of Big Poppy. Big Poppy's got a WAR of 1.9, while Bradley has a WAR of 2.1. It is what it is. It is what it is. Let's wrap it up here real quick. I want to get Brandon in here. I've been holding him on much longer on hold than I should have. Let's talk real quickly. Red Sox lead the American League in runs scored with 256. The Mariners are second at 201. Twins and the Royals are tied for the worst with 152. The Yankees are third at 168. The A's are fourth at 173. The Rays are fifth at 174. And as in the worst, third, fourth, and fifth worst in runs scored. White Sox, best ERA in the American League, 3.15. The Mariners have the second best ERA with 3.21. And surprisingly, the last place AL East Blue Jays have the third best ERA in the American League with 3.61. That to me is a surprise. The Jays are pitching that well. That offense isn't getting it done, and they're in last place in the AL East. That to me is maybe the story of the first quarter of the season so far. As far as who can't throw the ball very well, Twins are the worst with a 4.9 ERA. The A's are the second worst with 4.76. The Astros, I don't think this would shock you, was third worst at 4.54. The Tigers are fourth worst, 4.51. And then the Yankees are fifth worst with 4.19. The Red Sox are actually ninth, tied for the American League East at 4.07, middle of the pack in the American League. That's not a stunner, but can you win a division? Can you win a World Series if you're a middle-of-the-pack team when it comes to pitching? We'll see how that goes. If you look inside the numbers a little bit, let me wrap these up real quickly. Red Sox lead the American League in strikeouts from a pitching staff perspective. So they're striking out the most batters in the American League, 391 so far. The Yankees are the second most at 377, which is a little bit surprising because they're not pitching very well. They're not winning all that much these days, and yet they're second in strikeouts. You would think if you strike out a lot of batters, that's good for your team. Not doing a lot of good for the Yankees so far, at least. And the Rangers are third, 309. 309 strikeouts is from their pitching staff so far. Pretty good. It's not a stunner. They're second in the AL West and very much in the wild card hunt. As far as home runs allowed, this is a little bit of a surprise, but not really. The Twins have allowed the most home runs in baseball, or the American League, 62. They play in a very pitcher-friendly ballpark, but they do have Phil Hughes pitching for them. So I guess that could counteract the whole thing. You play in a huge park, but you throw out a guy who gives up home runs by the dozens. So that's the Twins. The Orioles are second with 32. That's what's kind of shocking. The Twins have allowed 62 home runs. Their pitching staff has given up 62. The second worst of the Orioles with 32. That's a pretty significant difference. And the Red Sox are third worst with 41. Our third best, I guess, with 41 allowed. The Orioles are the best at 32 home runs, I guess. So the worst in the American League, 62. The best as far as home runs allowed are the Orioles with 32. The Red Sox, as I said, are third best with 41. This might surprise you, not so much the Orioles who lead the American League in home runs, but the Rays are tied for the most home runs in the American League with 63. I don't think most people would have thought that the Rays would be leading the American League in home runs, but they're tied with the Orioles, which is not a surprise. The Angels are the worst with 37, followed by the Royals at 38, and the White Sox also at 38. That, I think, is a surprise. They've got some pretty good boppers over there. They've got a very hitter-friendly ballpark, and yet they're third least in home runs. And they're leading their division in wins. So that to me, is a little bit of a surprise. The Astros lead the American League in stolen bases with 39. The Red Sox and the Royals are second with 31, which that surprises any Red Sox fans, as you know. We just don't steal a lot of bases up here in Boston. I don't know if it's too cold or because the monster's so close that they're afraid they're going to run right past second into the monster if they steal too often. I don't know. But for the Red Sox to be second in stolen bases without Jacoby Ellsbury on the team, that is a surprise. But nonetheless, they are with 31. And the Orioles, no surprise that they're leading in home runs. It's not a shocker that they're also the worst in the American League at stolen bases. But when you've got the Astros leading with 39 and the Orioles in last with 6, yes, I said 6. The Orioles have stolen 6 bases this season. That is a surprise to me, and that's why I threw it out there. But I've taken way too long here. We're going to start getting right into our players in focus section. I want to bring in Brandon C. Williams from rotoexperts.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at BCWilliams71. Brandon, sorry for keeping you on hold so long. Great to have you on board. I don't know. I threw a lot of numbers out there. I don't know how many of those you're aware of, or how many of those mean anything to you, or if you even care. But of all of those numbers and all those stats I just tossed out in the last 20 minutes or so, does anything stand out at you? Does anything stick out as something that's meaningful versus not? What's your overall evaluation of the status of the game through 40-plus games statistically from the American League here?
I think that with the exception of the White Sox, if you take a deep breath and look at, you know, the American League, if you go back in, say, early March, start of spring training, and took a look at the landscape of the American League compared to where we are right now, I honestly don't feel too surprised about where things are. And it took some time over the weekend to think about this, and, you know, it does make some points. You know, if you look at the American League, and we touched on it, you know, the division is wide open. You know, the Blue Jays, you knew, were an all-or-nothing team offensively. I think during the offseason, everyone figured, well, what's going to happen to the rotation once David Price left? They've got one of the better rotations, one of the better pitching staffs in the American League. Unfortunately, you know, they've been all or nothing. You know, they can't get the long ball, they can't hit. You look at the Central, you knew the White Sox had the potential for good pitching. That was just a question as to whether or not they could get enough hitting to go around that. You know, you see, you know, you mentioned Adam Eaton has the highest WAR in the American League, and he's quietly put himself as a strong candidate for American League Most Valuable Player. Now, the Indians are starting to hit a little bit again. They've actually put themselves back into the thick of things. The Royals are starting to hit. But, again, we've got to figure with the Royals that, you know, maybe they held on to the band just a little longer. And it's a big mistake that most championship teams make. You want to hold on to the guys who got you to glory. And with the Royals, you know, and giving Alex Gordon a huge contract, justifiable, but at the same time, you know, there were signs of decline in his ball game. If you look at the American League West, and there's a great piece by Houston Chronicle sports columnist Brian Smith in today's Chronicle about how you kind of knew that we were getting sold a bill of goods by the Astros. And we'll get into that a little bit in the American League West, but let me throw out a couple more stats while we're throwing those out there. You look at the lineup that they had out there yesterday, and they got swept by the Rangers. Very embarrassing, though, by the way. You know, three games and they only managed four runs, you know, five runs in their last 36 innings. And if you look at the starting lineup that they had out there yesterday, only Jose Altuve was hitting above .254. Go figure that. You look at a team, and Brian makes a good point that, you know, we all got giddy when they jumped out to a 18-7 start last year, but if you look at the last 182 games, this is a team that's 85-97. So I think that if you took a – and I say this in the sense that, you know, you could have taken a look at the Astros. You could have taken a look at the lack of moves that they made in the offseason offensively. You know, the big deal obviously was getting Ken Giles. But if you looked at what they didn't do in order to upgrade their offense, you kind of figured that there was going to be a huge offensive letdown with that lineup. It wasn't a good offense last year, to be honest. They hit a lot of home runs. Jose Altuve, obviously, you know, great guy, you know, a great top of the order guy. You know, Carlos Correa injected some excitement in that offense, you know, with his ability to run, hit, you know, as well. But, you know, the bottom line is that this was a very mediocre team. And you're starting to see the results of that right now. You look at the fact, you know, you wake up today on Monday, they're 17-28. They're 10 games out of first place. And like I said last week, you know, we talked about what would be the biggest story going into this upcoming week. I said that, you know, what happened with the Astros in their six games against the White Sox and also the Rangers were going to tell the tale. They went 2-4 in those ballgames, including being swept by the Rangers. And at this point, I don't see where this team is getting back anywhere close to the divisional race. I don't think that they're going to be, you know, in Twins territory to where they're vying for the first overall pick in next year's draft. But this is a team that's just extremely mediocre. And mediocre is being kind, and mediocre is also trying to be one of the best words I can use without offending ears.
Well, you're down there, and so you have a little bit of a rooting interest. I don't know, who is your favorite baseball team? I mean, you're in Texas, so you've got a lot of teams to choose from. You're not that far from some other states, but I know you're a Philadelphia Eagles fan when it comes to football, but who's your team? It sounds like maybe your team is the Astros, and that's why you hate them. But I don't remember you ever saying that they are actually your favorite club.
I don't have a big baseball team, to be honest. No, I don't. You know, for a while I was a big Red Sox fan. You know, for most of my life I've been a Red Sox fan. But over the past couple of years I've just kind of been floating around as a free agent. You know, I just follow the game instead of, you know, cheering, you know, for a team. Now, if Montreal gets a baseball team again, I'll start rooting for them. I have an Expos cap just waiting for that day. So if the Expos get another team, you know, I will definitely be out there. So, but right now, I truly don't have a team. I'm kind of, you know, in my relationship status, you know, with the baseball team, it's kind of like my relationship status in life. I am single. So we'll just, you know, follow the game, you know, be excited about, you know, if the Astros get better, you know, I'll certainly be excited for them. You know, they are indeed the home team. I live about 10-minute drive away from Minute Maid Park. So, you know, I certainly root for them and hope that, you know, things work well. But right now, obviously, they are. And it is, again, a sense of disappointment. But yet, at the same time, if you took a close look at their stats, this was coming. You know, this was coming. And again, in a column by Brian Smith, you know, he points the finger, rightly so, at the owner, Jim Crane. You know, Crane did not do anything this offseason to try to upgrade this offense. I think that, you know, he truly felt that what he had out there, that, you know, Carlos Correa was going to hit 325 with 30 home runs, 120 RBI, and steal 25 bases. You know, he's getting what he got out of Altuve, but, you know, here's a guy who spent $15 million on Colby Rasmus. You know, how many teams in their right mind would have spent $15 million in offseason on Colby Rasmus? Not a bad ball player by any stretch of the imagination, but is he a $15.5 million ball player? Hell no. Let's be honest about that. You know, you look up and down their lineup, you know, Marwin Gonzalez, Luis Valbuena. These are guys that are getting significant at bats. These are guys that are starting. Jake Mareznick is starting, you know, because Carlos Gonzalez is on the disabled list. Carlos Gomez wasn't worth a damn. And, you know, Mareznick was hitting 116 after Sunday's game. So, you know, good gold glove caliber defender, but again, a ball player should not be getting that many at bats. You know, and it's easy to blame the pitching staff, and rightfully so. That's not a good pitching staff to begin with. And we have touched several times this season on the fact that, you know, how we were one of the few or some of the few that didn't get duped by belief that Dallas Keuchel's an elite number one starter. You know, Keuchel is a number two on a good team. Oh, a very good team is probably a number three. But the Astros have built this guy up. You know, he deservedly won a Cy Young last year. Put up good numbers. You know, they gave him a nice extension. And now you built this guy up to be something that he's not. And this is really the problem with the Astros. And really, you know, and I don't want to get too long into a tangent, but it's really kind of quintessentially, it's kind of like what the quintessentially what's wrong with Houston teams in the sense that they celebrate mediocrity. It is dead serious. You know, obviously there's great talent here in Houston. J.J. Watt, you know, you don't love J.J. Watt, you don't love America for the most part. James Harden, you know, is God bless, you know, shooter extraordinaire for the Rockets. And for the Astros, yeah, we're hoping that Carlos Correa can end up being that guy. But at the same time, you know, we celebrate the mediocrity, you know. We celebrate, you know, and you would think that when this team signed Brock Osweiler, this city signed Brock Osweiler to be the new quarterback, you were thinking that, you know, oh, here comes our savior. I was actually talking with a scout on Saturday, ran into him at a coffee shop. Right, so scout on Saturday, and he was telling us, like, you know, the Broncos were laughing at the Texans for giving them that kind of money. So, you know, we'll take it for what that is. But to get back into baseball, the bottom line is that, you know, Jim Crane put together a ball club that played over their heads for about a month and a half, was fortunate to play in a division that was horribly mediocre last season, you know, and they managed to win. They did not make any changes in the offseason. They figured that, oh, well, you know, we need to get that flame-throwing closer. So let's go ahead, rip up a good chunk of our minor league system to get Ken Giles, you know, an unproven closer on a last, you know, in a second division team. And this is what you get, you know, a guy who did not earn the starting job out of the preseason. He's pitched a little bit better, but for the most part, he's been, you know, a huge disappointment. Whereas, you know, Carlos Vasquez has, Vincent Vasquez has looked like an Leo, looked like a kid who's got a ton of upside in Philly. So when you look at the Astros, you look at the West, they're done. I'll go ahead and say it. They're done. I don't see where this team comes back. You know, I think that, you know, by the middle part of June, you're going to see a three-team race in that division. You're going to see actually a two-team race. It's going to come down to the Mariners. It will come down to the Rangers. It will come down to whether or not the Mariners can get enough offense, you know, to come together. They certainly have the pitching. And it comes down to, you know, what the Rangers plan to do as far as their bullpen and whether or not they're going to be willing to part with some of their top-end prospects. And we talked a little bit on this last week. You know, are they going to be willing to put up some of their top-end prospects in order to get the closer that they need that's going to be a difference maker? Seattle's got their guy, Steve Chiswick. They've got a pretty good bullpen. The Rangers, you are actually at a point where you're relying on Matt Bush, and this is a guy who's less than 2 years removed from being in prison. So I think that, you know, as deep as their minor league system is, if they're going to go out and try to grab a guy like, say, a Royce Chapman, or, you know, Royce Chapman's probably the one guy that could probably be out there at the deadline. And if they make a move, then they certainly have the prospects to do it. But this is a two-team race in the West. It's going to be Mariners. It's going to be Rangers. The Angels don't have enough talent to stay in it. Oakland, they'll play over their heads. They'll look pretty. They've got Sonny Gray on the DL right now, but that's going to be a major issue as well. So at the end of the day, I think that when you look at this Astros team, you look at the American League West, I think that, this is the team that, we all bought through their BS for the most part in Houston, and we're paying for it, bottom line.
Yeah, I think the Astros are a tough team to evaluate because they have a lot of talent. They have a lot of home runs on the offensive side of things. But I agree that there are some players in there that shouldn't be playing as often as they are right now. But some prospects really didn't come through. John Singleton was supposed to be a pretty good offensive player. And for whatever reason, whether it was how they handled him or the fact that maybe he's just not as good as we maybe thought, I thought John Singleton was actually a pretty nice player. I thought he'd be a good hitter in the major leagues. But it never happened. Same thing for A.J. Reed. His career isn't over. It looks like John Singleton either needs another organization or maybe he'll never have a career in the major leagues. It kind of looks like his day may have passed. A.J. Reed's has not. It's just his hasn't started yet. But it would have been nice if he could have been some kind of an impactful prospect in the major league level on opening day. Instead, they went with Tyler White, and that was a nice story, and it worked out for a couple weeks, but he's back to being what he is, which is a mediocre player at best. But yeah, those names you said, they're nice contributors. I just don't think you want them in there 130 times a season, and that's what they're doing. But how they were going to fix that, I don't really know. I mean, I don't know how much they could add. Maybe they shouldn't have let Chris Carter go, but again, they had a lot of DHs and a lot of power hitters. Evan Gattis, that was a kind of a strange trade, because Evan Gattis, he's catching now, but he's a bad catcher. At best, he's a bad catcher. So they traded for a guy who can't really catch on a team that has a bunch of home run players, and they don't know where to play. So they've got a whole bunch of guys that really should be DHing, which forced them to get rid of Chris Carter, which he would have been a nice addition for this team if they needed him. Unfortunately, they didn't, because they have a bunch of guys who strike out a lot, hit a lot of home runs, and can't play any defense. So they had to shove off one or two of them, and Chris Carter was one of them. But I don't know what they could have done in the offseason other than trying to add one of the big pitchers. If they wanted to be in on David Price or they wanted to be in on Jordan Zimmermann or one of those guys, I wouldn't have blamed them. I don't think any of those pitchers were great signings by any of those teams. But even at a 5.53 ERA or whatever I quoted out there for David Price, he's 5.53 with a 1.27 whip. That would have been better for the Astros than whatever they're throwing out there now. So if they should have added maybe one of those big arms, maybe they should have. Maybe they should have tried to get after Greinke. I don't know. But I don't know where on the offensive side in free agency last year they could have done what they needed to do. Justin Upton looks bad. Ian Desmond isn't exciting. He's right there down the street. You're seeing he's not a bad player. He came at a good deal, to be honest with you. But I don't know if he would have been the solution to the Astros being the worst team in the American League West. Offensively, I don't know what the Astros could have done to make a significant impact. And it's not like they have a bad offense now. It's just they have some holes, and it almost seems like a philosophical problem. They don't make enough contact. Jose Altuve makes a ton of contact. Carlos Correa probably will too. But there's a lot of strikeouts, and I wonder if maybe they need just a little less. A little less of that. And even if that meant a fewer home runs, I don't know if maybe they just need to make more contact. I don't know, but I don't know what the offseason could have
been. They're 29th in the majors in batting average. They're 29th. Only the Padres are worse at 221. The Astros as a team are hitting 229 as a team. You look at runs scored, they're 18th, and obviously a lot of that is generated by the long ball. They steal bases. They're amongst the league leaders in steals. With 39 swipes, you look at the numbers right now, they lead the majors with 39 stolen bases. So they have guys with talent. They have guys that if they can get on base, can do damage. But this is a team that does not make enough contact. You're right. They don't make enough contact at all. You look at the fact 445 strikeouts. They lead the majors in batter strikeouts, 445. And that, again, is a problem. If you look back, if you look, the Blue Jays are four. at 394, you know, these are two teams, you know, that are really a mirror image. The Blue Jays get the ball. You know, they have 58 home runs. The Astros have 56. The Blue Jays, they don't steal nearly as many bases as the Astros. You know, 14 steals for them compared to the Astros' 39. But, you know, you look at the fact of the matter is that, you know, these guys can't get on base. The Astros have a 312 OBP. Blue Jays are 315. And despite the fact that, you know, the lineup, especially in Toronto, is littered with guys that we've said, you know, are proven talents, you know, Batista, Tulowitzki, Encarnacion, Josh Donaldson, you know, Kevin Pillar is actually about the one guy who's really been hitting fairly well in the month of May. And if you look at these two teams, they're geared around the same philosophy. You know, let's just swing the bat and get the thing out of the ballpark. And if you can't do that, their weaknesses are horribly exposed. You have too many guys who do not make enough consistent contact in order to justify the success of that team. And, you know, and when they're not hitting, when both of these teams are hitting, and it's obviously showing that both of these teams aren't hitting, they're in last place. The Jays obviously are in a much better situation because they're playing in the American League East where you really don't have a clear-cut team. But when you look at the Astros, you know, they're 10 games back, 11 under 5, in a division that has two teams that probably stand a good chance of winning the American League. You know, you can make a strong case at this point for the Mariners. You know, really haven't hit the ball as well as they should be. You know, you still have guys like Kyle Seager that are struggling. And you look at the Rangers, they're 10th in offense in the majors. And this is despite the fact that Prince Fielder has struggled all season long. This despite the fact that, you know, Ian Kinsler got off, not Ian Kinsler, but Ian Desmond got off to the rough start, and he's hit the ball well since mid-April. You know, and you still have to consider the fact that they've got a minor league system that has produced Nomar Mazara. Mazara hit the ball real well over the weekend here in Houston. You know, we touched last week about the fact that they said, you know, this, the power going to come along. Power's starting to come along. And even when True comes back, he's going to remain in that lineup. He's a factor for the Rangers, a very strong factor. And at the same breath, you know, once Joey Gallo gets healthy and gets his bearings back, once he gets off the disabled list, you know, you're probably looking at by maybe late June, early July, Gallo could be a factor. And we talked a little bit last week about how once Gallo does come back up to the minors and he's off the minor league DL, he starts swinging the bat, you know, what would the Rangers do about putting that line and putting him in the lineup and maybe having him play some first base in favor of Prince Fielder, who's, you know, and we talked again, you know, last week, we talked about the fact that, you know, Fielder's game is probably done. You look at the hip injury that he's had, you're looking at a ball player who's probably never going to be the power hitter that he once was. So if you look at, you know, the Astros and, you know, you look at the Astros and the Blue Jays, you know, these are teams that just cannot generate offense unless the ball's deposited 300 some odd feet away or even, you know, further. If there's not a fan catching the baseball, these teams are useless.
Yeah, Prince Fielder is kind of a surprising story. I would have to say those injuries must have a significant impact because he used to be as consistent a player as it was. The power was always there. He hit around 300. He was probably one of the more underappreciated all-around really good hitters in baseball, and he did it for quite some time, at least five or six consecutive years of right there. And batting average is a lost art. A lot of guys don't hit for a good batting average anymore, but the best of the best, they slug, and they also – you don't see an MVP hitting 220 because if you don't make enough contact, you don't hit enough doubles, you don't – your OPS isn't up there. Contact and a good batting average comes along with the great players. Good hitters can hit 250, 260, have a pretty good OPS, and they're good sluggers. There's a lot of guys out there that do that. But usually the best of the best, they hit for power, but they're such good hitters, they walk a lot, so their on-base percentage is really good. But because they're such good hitters, and David Ortiz in his prime is the perfect example, they also hit for good batting average. It just comes along automatically. It's not like if you hit for a good batting average, you're a good player. a really good player just hits for a good batting average. It's just they go hand in hand. And Prince Fielder has had a really good career at batting average in, along with the home runs. And he's just not that anymore. To me, he's not much of a topic, to be honest, other than the fact that he's probably done. And the question is, they've still got to pay him a lot of money. Does Joey Gallo steal his at-bats, a significant amount of them? Or if Mitch Moreland gets heated up, does Prince Fielder find his way to the bench more often than it'll be an interesting story. And I guess people love to say it's a good problem to have. I don't know if it's a good problem to have a high-priced veteran possibly having to be benched. I don't think that's a good problem to have, but when you have a lot of players that are forcing that kind of decision, I guess there's at least a sunny side of that coin, I suppose. But we're talking American League Baseball with Brandon C. Williams from rotoexperts.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at BCWilliams71. If you want to talk fantasy sports with Brandon or myself, you can always do that in two places. One, you can talk with us on Facebook. It's a podcast to be named later. Just ask to join the group, and I'll allow you in, and we can talk baseball all day long if you'd like. But if you want to read about our fantasy content, head on over to rotoexperts.com. Brandon, let me get into some of the stats here, and I want to look at the home run guys first here. We've got some players that I like to get into focus, and Chris Davis is one of them. And it's Chris Davis with a K, not Chris Davis from the Orioles. It's Chris Davis from the A's. And it's a little surprising. One, he's been hitting a lot of home runs for a decent amount of time now, but he's done it in relative obscurity. And one of the stranger things is that usually OPS is a slugging category. The more bases that you get when you hit, the higher OPS is going to be. So you would think a guy who's second in the American League in home runs with 12. He's tied with Manny Machado and Robinson Cano. Technically, they're third because Mark Trumbo and Todd Frazier are tied for first at 13. Unlucky number 13. But nonetheless, Chris Davis has the second most home runs in the American League, and yet he has the lowest OPS of any of the home run hitters with a 751 OPS, and his WAR is 0.05. So zero means you're league average, which means you could be swapped out for another average player and the team would be just as well off. So at zero, you're basically interchangeable. He's 0.5, even though he's second in the American League in home runs with 12. What does that tell you about WAR, and B, what does it tell you about Chris Davis, who's launching bombs left and right? Again, it's Chris Davis with a K. He's launching a bunch of bombs. He's playing for Oakland, where they're a losing team, but yet he's got an OPS of 0.751, and he's barely above league average, which means if you've got a bench guy, Chris Davis is just barely better than your bench guy. What does that mean to you?
It means that he is a guy who is geared simply around around the home run. He's someone that when we did our fantasy baseball preview at rotoexperts.com, I did a little bit of focus on him. And this was a little before he was traded from Milwaukee to Oakland. But the signs were there that this is a guy who could hit for power regardless as to where he was. And I really didn't feel that it was going to make a difference from him. What I feel about him is that he thrived in Milwaukee last season. He hit .296, hit 16 of his home runs in Milwaukee last season. But he's a streak guy. 201 at bats over the last couple of months of 2015. He hit 20 home. He hit 20 home runs. So a guy with that kind of pace, tells you that, this guy's got some pop. But to me, 751 OPS, 263 on-base percentage, he's all or nothing kind of guy right now. But he's also capable of getting on streaks to where he'll make solid contact. Right now it just isn't. Last week, 300, four home runs, eight RBI, three of those came in one game, but if you look at his last 15 games during this week, he's hitting .218 with a .254 on base percentage. 564 slugging percentage is impressive because half of his 12 hits in that span have been home runs. But this is a guy who just does not make a lot of contact. Three walks in his last 30 games this season. He only has five walks and 158 at-bats this season. He struck out 42 times. So basically once every four at bat, he's going to strike out. At the same time, once every 12 or so at bat, he's going to go deep. So it's a double-edged sword when you put this guy to your lineup. He's probably going to, if he stays healthy, he's probably going to end up hitting like 30 home runs. He'll probably end up driving around, say, 85 or so. But it's going to be very hollow in the sense that unless he gets hot, it's going to be probably at the price of around, say, maybe a low 220 average all-base percentage that hovers around, say, maybe 250, and a ton of strikeouts. You know, he struck out 244 times the past 2 years leading up to this season. So the problem with him is that last year there was a point in time where you felt confident that he was going to show some progress at the plate. You know, he showed some patience, particularly in the second half of last year. But obviously that didn't carry over to Oakland. So I look at this guy entertaining. You know, he's a truly, you know, you can't really say he's a three true outcome guy because he doesn't walk enough to be established as that. He fits the A's well because he's playing on a team that's not very good, needs a power hitter. And in that ballpark, you know, he obviously shows that he can go deep, you know, in anyone's ballpark. But in that ballpark, you just need a guy who can give you minimal defense, which he does, gives you some pop. And let's just face it, that when the A's are good again, Chris Davis won't be around. Chris Davis is probably going to go that Chris Carter track, where he's going to spend the next 5 to 7 years, you know, flirting between, you know, showing that he could belong in the starting lineup and, you know, being on terrible teams where he can get 500 at bats, hit 25, 30 home runs, and still hit around 225, 230.
Yeah, it's kind of stunning that he's an on-base percentage of 263. That to me is pretty stunning. That normally, the one stat that on-base percentage, what it really tells you is it tells you how good a guy is. Obviously, it has to do with walks and selectivity. And anyone who watched the Moneyball movie knows that on-base percentage is mostly about walks. That's not actually true. If you have a good on-base percentage, you have a lot of walks. The reason why sluggers usually have good on-base percentages is because they wait for their pitch. They're not afraid to take strikes that aren't drivable strikes. And also, pitchers are afraid to pitch to them. So, therefore, you've got home run hitters that also have good on-base percentages. Now, you do have the occasional non-power hitter with good on-base percentages, but usually that's built almost entirely around a good batting average. So, for example, Jacoby Ellsbury, he's got something like a career on-base percentage of .350. Which is very good, but for a slugger, that's not – I mean, the best of the best sluggers are like 370 or above. Those are the elite sluggers because they walk a ton and they hit their home runs. So for an on-base guy to be 340 to 360, that's really done with skill. That's done with contact. That's with getting base hits, but also being selective enough where you're walking just enough to also walk. So it's a kind of a combination. But sluggers get pitched around – and that's why they end up with an on-base percentage that is so good, because pitchers don't want to give up home runs. They're more than happy to let them walk down to first base. But what they don't want them to do is jog around all four of the bases and slam in at home. Chris Davis hitting 12 home runs, second in the American League, but having an on-base percentage of .263. What that tells me is, while pitchers don't want to give up home runs, A, it may have something to do with the fact that the A's are never winning because they're a bad team. So therefore, you're not going to walk even power hitters. If they hit a home run, a solo shot is not a bad thing. You don't want to start giving up 2-3 grand slams. That's what kills a big lead. So you're going to throw strikes even to sluggers in games that are kind of getting out of control. So there could be a little bit of an explanation there. But what it really tells me is that pitchers aren't afraid to throw to Chris Davis because his contact tool is so bad that he's unlikely to hit home runs, even though when he does hit one, he hits a home run. So you'll see some guys like Chris Davis, the other one, the CH Chris Davis. While he may end up hitting 220, 230, 240, something like that, right now he's hitting 237. But he's got an on-base of 352, which is a little low for the elite sluggers, but that's a very good on-base percentage. Ian Kinsler's got one of 361. That's pretty impressive. David Ortiz has an on-base of 408. That is phenomenal. So Chris Davis at 352 with David Ortiz at 408. It's very good, Chris Davis the C. But the fact that he's at 263 means that no pitchers are afraid to throw to him. They know there's a chance they're going to give up the long ball to him, but they just, they're more than happy to take that risk because he's such a bad contact hitter that more often than not, they're better off just throwing him strikes. Don't let him walk. And that's why you see 5 walks in the season. I mean, that's incredible. Jose Bautista has walked 37 times. 37. Jose Bautista has walked 37 times. Chris Davis with a K has walked 5. And it's the same amount of at-bats, 158 to 161. That is kind of stunning. Moving on here, let's talk a little bit about some of the other, real quickly, the home run hitters. Does it surprise you that Cano was tied for second, technically, like I said, third, with 12 home runs? It's not a shocker that Manny Machado's there. To me, it's not a surprise that Todd Frazier tied for first. Mark Trumbo's had a phenomenal start, one of the better stories of the season. He's leading the American League in home runs with 13. But Robinson Cano with 12, plays in Seattle, had a pretty off season last year, though we got it together in the second half. Lots of excuses as to why that was. But does it surprise you that a guy who plays in Safeco Field like Cano is second in the American League in home runs, ahead of David Ortiz, ahead of Josh Donaldson, ahead of Jose Bautista, ahead of both of the Davises, or tied with one of the Davises ahead of the other one? Where's all of a sudden? I mean, he's on pace for possibly 30 home runs this year. That, to me, is an interesting story.
It is interesting, but if you look at his splits, it's, you know, the splits tell the tale. None of his home runs have been hit outside of Safeco Field. You look at what he's done outside of Seattle, you look at a guy who would probably be an MVP, you know, be a very strong MVP candidate. You know, outside of Seattle, he's hitting .343, 9 homers, 27 RBI, .398 on base percentage. You know, his OPS is .1094, but if you put him in Seattle, he ain't not so good. .213, 3 homers, 12 RBI, .263 on base percentage, and an OPS of .636. You know, whereas this guy looks like, you know, the second coming of Rogers Hornsby outside of Seattle. You know, he looks more along the lines of, you know, say Jeff Blauser, in Seattle. So that's part of the reason when I touched on the Mariners early that I think that's the thing that scares me is that a lot of these guys aren't hitting the ball well in Seattle. You look at Cano. You also look at Kyle Seager, amongst others. For some reason, these guys just are not hitting the ball at Safeco. It's almost as if, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, pitching staff, you know, we can just get you about 2 runs here at Safeco, handle business, and, you know, we'll take care of you. You know, we'll take care of you on the road because, you know, we'll score in bunches. And if you have a bad night outside of Seattle, don't worry because we'll score around 5 or 6 runs and it'll be enough. And that's the, you know, that to me, you know, is the intriguing thing about the Mariners. And Cano's, you know, is the poster boy for it. They've only played 18 home games thus far, so it favors them for the remainder of the season. They'll still have 63 home games remaining entering this week. And you'd have to hope that they can turn things around offensively, especially Cano, because you're going to need him consistently. You know, he's your big money guy. He's your brand, you know, he's the cornerstone of that offense. And if he's not clicking, you know, on all cylinders, be it at home or on the road, wherever they are, if he's not clicking, then the rest of that offense does not click. So I'm a little surprised that Cano is there amongst the home run leaders. I don't think that's going to continue the rest of the way, because what I can see him doing, especially in Seattle, I think he'll sacrifice some power for the batting average. I think he's going to try to work on being more of a contact hitter at Safeco until he feels more comfortable at the plate. You know, when you're on the road, yeah, you can rear out and let it go for all it's worth, and obviously he's done that. But I think that until they can make some adjustments offensively at Safeco, the Mariners are going to be that team that you really can't look at and say, I feel completely good about them. As a whole, I think that they can win that division, but until Cano and the rest of that offense comes along in Seattle, you know, at Safeco Field, I think that this is a team that's going to end up, you know, either, you know, using that pitching staff to stay into the thick of things or if the Rangers really surge, they're going to find themselves out of it before they even have a chance of staying in it.
I'm Chris Mitchell. This is a podcast to be named later with Brandon C. Williams joining me from MurdoExperts.com. Talking about American League Baseball here. We were just talking about the home run leaders, specifically Chris Davis and Robinson Cano. Now we're going to talk a little bit about pitching and ERA. Brandon, it's not a shock at who's sitting at the top of the ERA lead. Chris Sale at 1.58. It's probably a surprise. It's not a shocker to me. Jose Quintana in second place with an ERA of 1.98. I've always thought Jose Quintana is one of the most underappreciated, really good pitchers in baseball. Finally, with a 1.98, it's difficult to ignore him. So he's second. Again, for him to be that high, I think you have to be at least moderately impressed. But it doesn't stun me that he's up there. Felix Hernandez, third. Same thing as Quintana in some ways. Not that he's been underappreciated. We've known that Felix is a stud for quite some time. But he's throwing under 90 miles per hour, and yet he's got an ERA of 2.21. To me, throwing that soft and yet still really pitching well, that surprised me a little bit that he's pitching that well without the velocity. So that's a little bit of a surprise, but to have Felix Hernandez at the top of the ERA list, that is not – you expect that. It's just how he's done it has me a little bit of a surprise. Same thing with Jose Quintana and Danny Salazar at number four. He's got an ERA of 2.32. Anyone who's followed baseball closely knows that Salazar is filthy stuff. He's had a little bit of a command issue in the past. But he's got a whip of 1.12, so he's getting it done in all ways right now. So I don't think, again, it would be a shocker that Danny Salazar is in the top five in ERA. It's just I don't think he's as well known as other pitchers. So therefore, if you're just the average casual fan or you follow your market or your division and nothing else, I could see how seeing Salazar that high up on the list might catch your eye as a little bit of a surprise. I can understand that. But again, the guy's stuff is definitely top five worthy. You got Stephen Wright of the Red Sox at number five. That would be a shocker if you didn't know that he was a knuckleballer. And sometimes knuckleballers can be amazing. R.A. Dickey won a Cy Young. Tim Wakefield had a phenomenal career, and he almost won, I think, his first 20 starts one season. So knuckleballers can do fluky things. So it's not like Stephen Wright all of a sudden became a great pitcher. He's just the knuckleball is really working well. So for him to be in the top five, it's a surprise, but there's an explanation for it. Once you get outside the top five, that's where I think it gets very interesting. Jordan Zimmermann at sixth at 252. Goes from the National League to the American League. Goes from a pitcher-friendly park to another pitcher-friendly park. A team who now has pretty good defense. With Ian Kinsler at second, Jose Iglesias at shortstop. Justin Upton's a pretty good defensive left fielder. I wouldn't say he's a great defender in general. But left field, the standard for defense is pretty low. I would consider Upton probably to be a little bit better than the standard left fielder. I believe he's playing left field now. But Jordan Zimmermann at sixth, Rich Hill seventh, Marco Estrada eighth, tied with Chris Tillman, and then Colby Lewis 10th. And Aaron Sanchez is 12th, Ian Kennedy 13th, and Nathan Carden's 15th. So Nathan Carden's the guy I was very high on coming this year. I wrote up the fantasy pitching rankings for Baseball America's fantasy magazine this year. And I had Nathan Carden much higher than I think a lot of people would. So him being at 15th doesn't stun me, but I think it's a surprise nonetheless. There's a lot of interesting – A, Jordan Zimmermann, 40 strikeouts in 60 innings. Hardly impressive. He's only walked 11 batters, though, and that's one of the better walks totals in the American League, tied with Jose Quintana. I'm not a big Jordan Zimmermann believer. I've heard a lot of people say that this guy's really good. You just don't realize it. I've realized that he's pretty good. I've never thought he was really, really good. He's sixth in the American League, 60 innings pitched, 2.52 ERA, 1.14 whip. So it looks like the ERA and whip are kind of in line where he is pitching well and he's preventing runs. But Jordan Zimmermann, sixth, Hill, seven, Estrada, eight with Tillman, and Colby Lewis, 10. What are your thoughts on those guys rounding out the top 10? To me, I was high on Rich Hill, but I didn't have him as the seventh best pitcher in the American League through 40 games. What's your thoughts on the back end of the top 10 in the ERA so far for the American League?
Oh, each season, you get a few surprises here and there. And, Tillman has been the closest thing the Orioles have had to an ace in a very long time. He's not terribly pretty for the most part. But this year looks like, he could be on course for a career year. He's never really been a big strikeout guy. But he's got 53 or 51 and two-thirds innings. So he's making batters miss the ball right now. And I think that's a huge reason why, you know, he's been so successful so far this year. You know, he's getting that swing and miss element to his game, and that's part of the reason why he is 6-1. 213 batting average allowed. You know, the guy has shown, again, that now that he is able to strike out hitters, I think that brings an extra element to his game. And I think that's a reason why Orioles fans can feel good about the fact that as we get further along to the season and things begin to get tighter, that perhaps they might have their guy in Tillman. It might also, you know, if he continues to pitch that way, it might preclude them from looking to go after an ace. I think they will certainly go and grab some added pitching, but as far as, you know, breaking the bank to go out and grab one, I don't think that's the case if he can stay that way. Marco Estrada is a guy that I like. I like his stuff. 50 strikeouts, 51 and a 2/3 innings. Only 1-2, and that shows you the fact that, you know, the Blue Jays just cannot put runs together for him or pretty much anyone on that staff. You know, more impressive is the fact that opponents are hitting just 187 against. He's got a 105 whip as well. So I look at Estrada, a guy who is, you know, at age 32 has really come out of nowhere, to be honest, and has put together a pretty solid season. He's away from the Brewers. He's been away from the Brewers. You know, he was 13-8 last year and put up numbers pretty similar to what he's done this season. The only difference is that he's striking out more people. You look at the rest of that, you know, if you look at, again, the back end, Cole Hamels, Colby Lewis. Hamels, you kind of figured was going to be there. Guy's still, you know, a solid pitcher, probably one of the better in the American League. Colby Lewis, a little bit of a surprise, but this guy's also a veteran in there as well. You know, between the two of them, they're 8-0. So that's part of the reason why the Rangers are in the thick of things. Rich Hill, again, agreed. I think he's been a very big surprise. It was a very shrewd move by the A's to pick him up. And it's paid off quite well. It can pay off quite handsomely at the deadline because I'm pretty sure Billy Beane can find a way to package him. Jordan Zimmermann, a guy that a good pitcher. I've never viewed him as great. He had a tremendous April, where he started at 5-0, a little bit ordinary in May at 2-2, but he's been the best pitcher on a very disappointing Tigers staff. Steven Wright's a bit of a surprise in there as well, just 3-4, but opponents are only hitting 202 against him. He's only given up 3 home runs in 53 2/3 innings. I do like Nathan Carnes in there as well. I like Carnes as a potential sleeper going into this season. I thought that, you know, if he could pitch well, he could really be a big factor for the Mariners, and he's shown that. He got roughed around his first couple of starts, but since then he's really settled in and has been pretty solid. You know, he's a guy who's striking out a batter in it. He struck out 48-46. Walks are a wee bit of a concern. He's got 18-46 innings. Support rates wise, whip up 1.28 is the highest of any of the top 15, but he's only allowing just hitters. They hit 237 against him. And the home runs are also a tad of a concern, 5-46 innings. Give him a home run game on average, but it's not enough, you know, to be really concerned about. You look at some of the other guys that, you know, that could be better. You know, you get past the top 15. You know, you look at guys like a Tomlin, Edison Volquez, Jake Odorizzi, you know, Marcus Stroman. Those are guys who can be better as the season goes on. You know, and number 26 in the American League ERA, Corey Kluber at 4.10. That's not going to stay that way. Let's bank on that one. You know, he's got a 1.11 whip, 58 Ks, 59 2/3 innings. He's only walked 15. I think that he's a guy who's only going to get better. And, you know, once they get Carrasco back, I think that this Indians team can really make things interesting and really begin to put some pressure on the White Sox.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I did want to talk about some of the surprises. We're talking about who has been performing well, but someone has to regress or someone has to do better. And that's where I compare. You look at the ERA and you look at the whip, and Corey Kluber is – I want to get into the negatives, the guy that we're going to – I'm a Boston guy. I love to harp on the negative and the bad. But Kluber is on the opposite side of that. To have a 1.11 whip but an ERA over 4, with those strikeout numbers, with those low walk numbers, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And you've got a defensive player like Lindor at shortstop, you would think that, you know, defense, I think, plays a lot into whip versus ERA. It's just to have a whip that good. 1.11 is one of the five or six best whips in the American League, one of the top 10 anyway. And yet he's 26th in ERA. That doesn't jive. That doesn't make sense. So that's how you look to see who's pitching better than they should be or who's pitching worse. Kluber is pitching better than his ERA suggests. And I wanted to ask you about who's pitching worse than their ERA would suggest. And the first name that jumps right at you is Colby Lewis, but the numbers don't tell you that. Colby Lewis has 44 strikeouts and 59 innings. That's hardly a lot, but that's more than Jordan Zimmermann. But that's not a high number. You'd like to see closer to a strikeout per inning. So 44 and 59 is reason for expectations. I don't have his BABIP, his batting average of balls in play, in front of me, but my guess is with a little bit of a low strikeout total for innings pitched, that he's probably getting a little bit lucky. But if you want to just look at it real quickly, rather than getting into swing and miss rates and like I said, BABIP and all the rest, if you don't want to do all the research it takes to look at all of those metrics to try to come to your own conclusion from that, you could just quickly look at ERA and WHIP. Does a guy have a 4 ERA but a 1 WHIP? That means the guy's pitching better than his ERA suggests. Colby Lewis, that's not the case. He's got a 2.7 ERA, which is very good. You would think maybe he'd have like a Cole Hamels type of whip would be a little bit of a concern. I'll get into him next. But his whip is 1.10. He has the third best whip in the American League, even though he has the 10th best ERA. So you could argue he should be higher. You could argue his ERA should be better based on that whip. Now, the lack of strikeouts, he also has a low walk total, so those counteract. But you would like to see more strikeouts to feel a little bit more confident. But it surprises me that Colby Lewis's ERA is so good and that his whip actually matches it. That surprises me. Looking at Cole Hamels is a little bit of the opposite. I'm not overly disturbed, but the strikeouts are there, so that's a good sign. But 2.83 ERA, 11th best in the American League, but he's got a whip of 1.26. That means that he's allowing more walks and more base hits than Corey Kluber, even though he's got an ERA of almost a point and a quarter worse, better. So his ERA is a point and a quarter better, but his whip is worse. That to me means that maybe Cole Hamels is in for a little bit of trouble. He's got 21 walks. He has allowed 51 hits. So he's allowed almost a hit per inning. So even though he struck out 62 guys, which is more than a strikeout per inning, 57.1 innings pitched, you see Cole Hamels more than I do. One of the concerns of him coming to the American League was that he would struggle to get American League hitters out. He would still be a good pitcher, but he's paid like a top-of-the-rotation guy. His numbers suggest that he is a top-of-the-rotation guy, but like I said, the whip is a little bit higher. The base hits are a little bit higher than maybe you'd like to see. Is Hamels a guy that could regress, or is he pitching to exactly he should be? Maybe the ERA goes up a little bit, but a little bit won't matter. If he goes from 2.83 to 4, that's meaningful. Is Cole Hamels going to continue this, or are there reasons of concern, and will there possibly be some regression there?
There might be a tad bit of regression, but I think that it won't be enough to where it's a cause of concern. You got to also consider the fact that the guy pitches half his games in Arlington, so chances are good he's going to get into a contest where, you know, he gives up runs. That's just bound to happen. You look at his numbers right now. As you would suspect, he's a much better pitcher outside of Texas than he is in Arlington. At home, 3.94 ERA, a whip of 1.48. It stands to reason because, again, it is a strong hitter's park. But, again, you go outside of Arlington, he's 3-0, 1.63 ERA. Opponents are hitting just 1.90 against him. He's given up just 4 home runs in 27 to 30 innings outside of Texas compared to 6 home runs that he's got at Texas. The big concern with me is the fact that he does tend to give up home runs. He's given up 10 so far this season, and that is probably something that will continue to trend. I think the problem with him, the hope is that, those home runs or solo shots. If that's the case, you can live with that. But if he's getting up 3-run jacks here and there, then that's a big problem. You also got to consider the guy's got a lifetime ERA of 3.30. So if he gets to that, you know, you're fine. I'm fine if he's, you know, in that 330, 340 range, because it's about what you'd expect out of him. You know, his whip's probably a little higher than normal. You know, he's got a career whip of 1.15, but 1.26. And again, throw into consideration the fact of where he's in, a very strong hitter's park. You know, it kind of comes to the fact that, you know, you accept it for what it is. You know, plus you also have to remember he's used to pitching in hitter's parks. Remember, the guy pitched in Philadelphia, he's pitched, you know, at Citizens Bank Park for most of his career, and did fairly well doing so. He is viewed as a top-of-the-line guy. You know, the Rangers paid top-of-the-line money to get him, but I think that once you get Yu Darvish back, and he is expected to be back on Saturday, I think once you get him back, I think that, you know, it's really going to make Hamels and Lewis even stronger. And once, you know, you get about 3 to 5 starts out of Darvish, and he looks a lot like the Darvish of old, that's going to make, again, it will make Hamels, it will make Lewis even stronger. It will make that rotation even more potent.
And looking at this list, there's a lot of good regression candidates in here. We won't have time to get into the guys that are going to improve. You mentioned Corey Kluber being one of them, and I agree with you. But looking at this top 10 or 15, top 20 guys on this list, who are the guys? I mean, for example, Martin Perez is at 18. He's got a 3.48 ERA, but he's got a 1.34 whip. That tells me that his ERA has a pretty good chance of going up, and maybe going up significantly, and that's not going to help Texas. Though, like you said, Yu Darvish is going to do a lot to help them maintain this pace. But Martin Perez, I think, is due for regression. But you look at that, there's a lot of names. Steven Wright is a knuckleballer. We're not even going to talk about knuckleballers. Those guys are completely unpredictable. So for him to continue to pitch to a 2.52 ERA and a 1.0 whip, he could do it, but if you're betting, you always would bet against it. So he's a knuckleballer. We won't even get into him. But Zimmerman, Hill, Estrada, Tillman, Lewis, Aaron Sanchez, Ian Kennedy pitching for the Royals, J.A. Happ pitching in Toronto. How he's able to pitch to a 3.43 ERA in the American League in the Rogers Center is beyond me. Rick Porcello with a 3.47. Of all of these guys, which are the ones that are the biggest surprises to be in the top 20 in ERA so far, and which ones are you expecting to drop off as we get deeper and deeper into their inning totals?
Again, you look at the top 15, you know, Wright's a surprise. I wouldn't necessarily say Rich Hill's a surprise. You know, again, Estrada pitched well enough last year to indicate that he could be a surprise. You know, he's really not the big of a surprise. Aaron Sanchez, I think that he could stay the same. Ian Kennedy, regression is to me, a regression candidate. He's pitching well, you know, 50 strikeouts, 50 innings, you know, 1.12 whip. But again, you know, if you look at his record, he does tend to fade out the second half. Jay Happ is a guy who's pitching over his head in Toronto. I think get the sense that, you know, I get the sense that if the Blue Jays don't get their offense going, you know, you can really see that rotation implode at some point in time by the second half. Mark Perez is 1-4 with a 3.48 ERA. Like I said, you know, a 1.34 whip, huge concern right there. I do like Edison Volquez to rebound. He's at 3.79 ERA, 1.39 whip. I think that there could be some strong resurgence by him, especially once the Royals can get their bats back. Marcus Stroman, 5-1, 3.89 ERA. You know, he's been fairly dazzling. I do feel a sense of disappointment in the sense that only 46 strikeouts and 69 innings. I think there could be a certain level of concern right there. Matt Latos, the guy that I wrote about on rotoexperts.com when he got off to such a strong start. He's got an ERA of 4. He's here getting hit at the clip of 2.78. His whip is at 1.47. He's going to be the guy who's going to be odd man out in that White Sox rotation. I really don't see him getting much better. He's probably a guy who's probably going to end up being spot starter, middle relief, because part of the reason is the fact he can't get in most of his starts. If I'm looking at other guys who I think could be surprises and end up getting better as the season goes on, Carlos Rodon with the White Sox, I think that this guy could really be solid. My concern, again, high whip rate, 1.47. Opponents hitting 2.79 against him, but I think the stuff is so good to where he can turn things around and have a pretty strong second half. Hiashi Iwakuma is another guy I think could be fairly strong. 2-4, 4.39 ERA. My big concern with him is that he's walking way too many hitters than he has been since coming over to the States. 17 walks in 55 innings, a 1.41 whip. And, yeah, that 2.84 ERA is a huge concern to me. But I think that this is a guy who's just coming out of the gate a bit slow. If you look at his track record, I think that he can have a very strong second half in front of him. Do I feel good enough to say that Justin Verlander can come around and be better? Yeah, I think the numbers are showing that he can be. You look at, you know, take away the 4.58 ERA, you're looking at a guy who's back to striking out a batter per inning, a 1.23 whip, 2.38 ERA. I think the question is if the rate, if the Tigers can generate enough offense around him and give him the opportunity to win some contests. You know, he's never going to be the Verlander that he once was, but I think that he can still be a fairly solid top-of-the-rotation kind of guy.
It's Brandon C. Williams and Chris Mitchell. This is a podcast to be named later. We're talking American League Baseball today. We've got about 10 minutes remaining in the program here. We're going to zoom through the divisions, AL East, AL Central, and AL West real quickly. Looking at the East, the Red Sox are just tearing it up. And while they probably have room for improvement when it comes to the starting pitching, David Price has to pitch better. Rick Porcello actually has room for improvement if you look at his whip. So this team, Eduardo Rodriguez, should be coming back in the next few weeks. I don't know how much of a boost that will be, but when you look at Clay Buchholz, anything would be a good thing, probably. So, and their fifth starter is a mystery at this moment. Steven Wright's probably going to regress. But the Red Sox have room for improvement while their offense has room to regress. But overall, I think the Red Sox have shown on both sides of the ball that they have a chance to at least be in the top two or three in this division throughout the season. So I don't see a lot of surprise in this Red Sox team. How exactly they're getting it done with a little more offense than you would expect and the pitching maybe not as good as it should be or needs to be. But to me, they're not a huge story. To me, it's the top of the division and the bottom. The Orioles, how they're pitching as well as they are is surprising to me, but it's why they're at the top, but can they do it? And then you look at the Jays. They're pitching better than you probably would expect, though they're not leading the division or leading the American League in any way, but they're competitive and they're getting it done pretty well as far as pitching goes. But the offense is struggling. So looking at the O's and looking at the Jays in this division, which team flip-flops their season? Do the Jays start getting better, or does the pitching start getting worse and they stay at the bottom? The Orioles, does the pitching come back, or does it continue to do this? Or do they fall to the middle? To me, that's the story, the bookends of this AL East, the Orioles and the Jays. Give me your opinion of the AL East in general, if you agree or disagree with that, and what are your thoughts on whether the O's or the Jays continue going as they are, or are we going to see some changes, regression or improvement?
I think you'll see some regression in the Orioles. You start to see it a bit. They're fifth in the AL and ERA after being in the top three for a good part of the season. Question is that, you know, whether or not the bullpen can hold up right now. That's really, to me, the big question with them. I don't think there's any question that they can hit. Certainly showing their second and third in the AL batting average. They lead the league in home runs. Sixth in runs scored, those are numbers that I think that will go up. They're going to continue to hit. When you look at the Blue Jays, I'm beginning to get concerned about this team. You know, for the past couple of weeks, I've been saying that, you know, things will turn around, things will turn around, things will turn around. It's just not happening at this point. They're seventh in the AL in runs scored. Their third ERA, but that ERA has actually taken a bit of a climb over the past couple of weeks as well. One of the things that they have to hope for is that, you know, not only can they hope that they can get some offense back from some of their big guns, but at the same time, they may have to look at, you know, using one of their bargaining chips in order to try to find some offense. And there's possibility that, you know, Drew Storen could be put out there. Toronto Sun's reporting that, you know, he had a host of teams looking to scout Storen over the weekend. He actually could be a pretty good setup guy for someone. He'll also be a closer for a handful of teams. Obviously, the Jays are going to look for some sort of offense in order to get him. At this point, I'm still holding out hope. You know, if you look at the Jays' schedule this week, it's going to be pretty intriguing. They've got a three-game set at New York against the Yankees. They get the Red Sox in for three before flipping things around, where they get a three-game set with the Yankees starting Memorial Day before a three-game set at Boston. Talk to me on June 5th about the Toronto Blue Jays. And if they're a bit better and they're out the cellar and they're killing the ball like they used to, I'll start feeling good about them. Although, you know, Jose Bautista is homered in three straight games, slugging percentage is getting close to 500. That's a positive side as well. But, you know, you look at this next 2 weeks for the Blue Jays. Talk to me again on June 6th. Let's talk about it. If they're hitting the ball and out of last place, I'll start feeling good about them. But if they continue to waste good pitching performance and losing a lot of 3-2 ball games because they can't move runners over or still going all or nothing, I would get very, very concerned about this team. And I'd also get very, very concerned about John Gibbons' status as leading that squad as manager.
Yeah, it's not that bad to be in last place and six games out of first place if things are heading the right direction at this pace, at this part of the season. You don't want to be back. You don't want to be six games back. Don't get me wrong. But there's still plenty of baseball. And if you have a lot of improvement ahead of you, you can do that. If you are what you are at this stage and you're six games back, then you have to be nervous. But if there's room for improvement or regression, depending on which way you go, yeah, it's not the end of the world. It's only six games. And the Jays, I think, have the roster to say, okay, six games is not the end of the world. I agree that they definitely have a shot. But they need to keep pitching well, and the offense has to turn around. And Jose Bautista had four home runs in the last week. So it looks like he's starting to get it together. Gibbons actually made what looks like a smart move. He put him in the leadoff spot, so which is kind of strange, but it seems like it got him going a little bit. And we'll see if that continues. AL Central. I was looking at the Cleveland Indians, and I said, wow, they're only 2.5 back. I thought the White Sox were running away with this division. We talked about them 2 weeks ago, and they were. Now, all of a sudden, the Cleveland Indians are only 2.5 back. I'm like, how are they only 2.5 back? Well, the White Sox are 3-7 in their last 10. They seem to be slumping a little bit, even though their pitching staff is getting it done. Cleveland's been able to do it essentially without Michael Brantley and without Carlos Carrasco. So for them to be able to stay this close – with reinforcements, nothing but on the way. Kluber with his ERA, like we talked about, he's pitched better than his ERA suggests. Is this White Sox team not that great? Is that why the Indians are this close? I don't know. Losing 7 out of 10 for a team that was running away with the division that looked like maybe the best team in the American League, or at least one of the top two or three, especially with how well all those left-handed pitchers have been throwing this season. What do you make of the Chicago White Sox? Why aren't they 6 or 7 up on Cleveland rather than just 2.5? Cleveland's undermanned. The White Sox really should have feasted, and it looks like they've blown an opportunity, at least in the last couple of weeks.
Because when you look at the fact that, you know, back in April they loaded up on a very soft schedule. You know, you look at what's happening to them right now, they're playing much better competition. Some of those losses in the last 10 games have come at the expense of a Yankees team that has struggled. They also ended up losing 2 out of 3 to the Astros this past week before, you know, going to weekend losing 2 out of 3 to the Royals. And things are going to get better for them. They started a four-game set at home against the Indians tonight and really could, you know, it's a strong possibility that, you know, by Friday morning, you could have a new leader in the American League Central. You know, and it, again, doesn't get better for them. They have a four-game set against Kansas City, and that's at KC. Then the end of the month, you know, interleague matchup at New York against the Mets. So the competition has gotten tougher for them, and we're starting to begin to see why this team, you know, is starting to show holes right now. The pitching is still good, but it's the offense that's a big concern. You know, they're 13th in home runs with 38. They're fourth, and they're eighth in batting average. They're eighth in runs scored. You look at the fact that, you know, Jose Abreu has been benched recently because his bat hasn't come together. You know, you're wheeling out Jimmy Rollins, you know, at a bat, you know, that's 231. You know, Abreu, you know, at 246, definitely not there. You know, Frazier, the power is certainly there, but he's hitting 228. And you take away Eaton, you take away the contributions of Eaton and Melky Cabrera, you know, this is a team that, you know, kind of looks like the Astros in the sense that, you know, they can't hit the ball. They, you know, the difference between them and the Astros is that the Astros can hit home runs, whereas the White Sox are scuffling. They don't have power. And if you look at this division, there's, you know, teams that can load up and give you some pop. But the bottom line is that we're starting to see just how difficult, you know, things are for this team because of the schedule. And that's really the bottom line. You know, are things going to get better? It may not. you know, we may look at this team, you know, as just, you know, a good pitch, no-hit squad that slowly but surely starts sinking out of the chase, because the Indians are starting to hit the ball again. The Royals are starting to show signs of hitting the ball again. You know, you look at the last 10 games, neither one of them, you know, been great, you know, 6-4. Nothing, you know, great, nothing great shakes about it, but it's a lot better than what it has been for them. And now you look at the Royals. They've got an interesting schedule coming up. You know, they get 3 cupcakes at Minnesota starting today. But then you mentioned the 4-game set against the White Sox. Then they've got a 3-game set at home against Tampa Bay. So that's going to be a very interesting stretch to see how that plays out with them. You know, if you look at what the Indians have lying ahead, you look at what they have lying ahead in their schedule. The fact is, yeah, they've lost their last 2 going into this series. But, you know, once you get past the White Sox, they've got a rough road ahead. It's a homestand, but it's against the first-place Orioles. And then following that, you've got the Rangers. So you're going to have to win some slugfest, you know, if you're Cleveland over the next couple of weeks in order to stay into the thick of things. It helps that Carlos Santana is starting to get hot late. You'd like to hope that, you know, they can start generating some offense behind someone other than Santana and Francisco Lindor. You know the pitcher is going to be well. You know what you're going to get out of Carrasco, especially once he comes back. It's just really a case of, you know, can you continue to rely on Lindor, Santana? Can Mike Napoli give you a little more offense? You know, can Reggie Davis, you know, continue to play as well as he has the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, and I ignored the Yankees and the Rays when we talked about the East because I just don't think that they're very good teams. So I don't think that they're going to be able to kind of catch up to the Red Sox, the Orioles, or the Jays if they improve. I'm not so sure about the Royals or the Tigers. This division in the Central looks like they could possibly be in it all year long. And again, Detroit's only 4.5 back. Kansas City's 3.5. Cleveland is 2.5. Are you a believer in Kansas City or Detroit? Are you a believer in both, or are you a believer in neither?
I believe in Kansas City. I think this is a veteran team that will find a way to get things going. I think that's the most important thing when you look at the Royals. You know, again, they're the defending world champions. They've got a bunch of veteran guys, you know, that have been through this the past couple of years off the slow starts. You know, you're starting to see some signs that, you know, they start picking, that the offense is starting to pick up. And if you can get guys like Lorenzo Cain and Alex Gordon to start hitting the ball well, and once you get Mike Moustakas back off the disabled list, I think this will be a team that will make things very, very interesting. And at the same breath, you really can't count the Tigers out. You know, now that you've got Cameron Maven back, and he's, you know, obviously he's going to cool off offensively. But I think the thing that you want Maven, you know, for is defense. The guy's a gold glove caliber defender in center field. What that does is that it's going to move Justin up and back to left field and give him a little pressure off him and allows him to focus on swinging the bat compared to trying to, you know, play out of position. I think that if the Tigers can continue to get good pitching out of Zimmerman, if Verlander can come back and start looking like, you know, flashes of the Verlander of old, and if somehow, someway, Aníbal Sanchez can get out of his early season slump, you really can't count the White Sox. You really can't count the Tigers out of this division as of yet.
And to wrap up the AL West, you were extremely critical of the Astros, so I don't think that they're going to turn it around like we think the Toronto Blue Jays might. Is this a two-team race for the rest of the AL West, the Seattle Mariners and the Rangers? And if one of them obviously isn't going to win the division, are both of these also wildcard contenders, or is this a win the West or go home scenario with these two?
I think that, you know, whoever wins the West is, you know, I think whoever finishes second in the West is going to get one of the wild cards. You know, the Mariners, you know, they've got a very impressive +48 run differential. And you look at it in the American League, you know, the only team that's got a better run differential is the Red Sox. So to me, that gives me a sign that they're going to get better. You know, the problem is that, you know, they're 12-13 against AL West teams this season, although they're feasting on the East and Central, where they've got a combined record of 11-4. They've won 4 straight going into the week. And I do like the fact that, you know, this Mariners team, you know, like I mentioned earlier when we talked about, you know, if they can start hitting the ball at home, and they're going to have to start doing it because they've got a stand coming up. They've got a home stand coming up starting this week with Oakland. They've got 3 games against the A's. You've got 3 against the Mariners. And then you've got home and home next week where you've got 2, games at Safeco against the Padres before you start June and flip it back with two games out there. So to me, I think that this is an opportunity for them to really start fattening up in this division, whereas if you look at the Rangers, you know, they've got a little bit of a challenge. The Mariners do have to replace Kessel Marte. You know, went on the DL on Saturday. They went out and put Leonis Martin at the leadoff spot. And what did he do? He went 4-for-5 with a run score. So if, you know, Martin can hit like that atop the order while Marte is out, then this really could make this Mariners team real strong. You know, real quick, you know, if you take a look at what the Rangers, what lies ahead for them, it's going to be very, very interesting for them as well. You know, they come off the momentum of sweeping the Astros. You look at what lies ahead. They've got an interesting schedule. You know, they've got 3 at home against the Angels starting this week. Very interesting series this weekend where you've got the Pirates out here for 3. And you close out the month with those 3 games we mentioned at Cleveland. And then, you know, June 3rd through 5th, it's a 3-game set at home against Seattle. And that is going to be a very interesting matchup to watch. Like I mentioned, Yu Darvish is slated to start on Saturday. It's looking like he will get the national primetime start against the Pirates on Fox Sports. So if you can get him back and looking like the Yu Darvish, who was a former All-Star, a guy that was truly a frontline arm, and you look at, you know, what he did in the minors, you have to feel good about it, you know. 3 runs, 2 earned, and 20 innings and 5 rehab starts, 21 strikeouts, just 9 hits allowed. If you can get that Yu Darvish back, the Rangers could really be the team that runs away with this division. I still like the Mariners, but right now, if you get Darvish back, and again, if Darvish looks like the Yu Darvish of old, this thing could really shift heavily in the favor of the Texas Rangers.
Brand C. Williams from RotoExperts.com talking a little bit of American League Baseball with us today. Thanks a lot, Brand, for coming on board. If you want to follow him, you can follow him on Twitter at BCWilliams71. But thanks again, Brandon. Love talking baseball with you. Hopefully we'll talk more later in the week, but we'll definitely be back next Sunday. Thanks a lot, man. Good luck today, and good luck down there in Texas.
All right. Thanks to you. We'll see you on Sunday.
All right, everybody, that's our program for today. We rounded about. We talked about some players. We looked at some statistics. We looked at the inside the numbers, home runs, ERA, whip. We even talked some war today, of all things, here on a podcast to be named later. If you want to follow us, you can do that in a variety of different places. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at CJMitch73. If you want to read my content or pick up the podcast on our website, it's minorleagueball.com. It's not my website. I post these at minorleagueball.com, which is part of SB Nation. You can head on over there, again, minorleagueball.com. Or if you want to see a rundown for the programs, or you can get the links to the programs, or you just want to talk baseball with us, you can do that on Facebook. It's a podcast to be named later is the name of the group. But you can also do that on Twitter. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73, I post links to all the programs. I give you little snippets of what the topics are going to be. But if you want the more detailed information, or you just want to talk baseball with us, join us on Facebook and post some topics in there. A podcast to be named later. Later on in the week, lots of different topics to get to. Excited to talk more baseball with you, so keep in touch. Follow me on Twitter, and be good, everybody. Thanks for joining us.